funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the future of healthcare in America? Is there an ideal balance between public access and private coverage? And will there be adequate protections to ensure that increased government intervention in the healthcare system doesn't define the value of human lives according to the cost of the care they require? There are important questions to be considered and valid concerns on both sides of the debate, but some observers worry that the tone of the arguments in recent weeks may actually make it harder for us as voters to understand what is being proposed. Joining us to talk about what they have learned in covering the healthcare overhaul are two North Texas journalists. Steve Jacob writes for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. William McKenzie is with the Dallas Morning News. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
There does seem to be a lot of fear out there, and supporters of the overhaul are talking as if this is grounded only in people's resistance to change. And I wonder if you think that's an adequate, a fair assessment.
Well, I think it is such a complex topic. It's somewhat like school finance here in the state. I mean, it is filled with details and very arcane data that it is it is hard to follow. So it's natural that people don't know exactly what is being talked about in the House and the Senate versions of it. So I think there's part of that that is quite legitimate. On the other hand, you have groups that are able to zero in on a portion of it, like these death panels that we've been hearing about, and milk that for all it's worth. So I think it's both.
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with the way President Obama has approached this. When Bill Clinton did this in the early 90s, he basically, along with his people, put together his health reform and just kind of plopped it on Congress's doorstep. And that's one of the reasons it failed miserably. And really, the Obama approach is almost 180 to that, in that he doesn't have a plan. You know, Obamacare is really just a slogan. So really what's happened is that everybody's kind of filling in the blanks with their own fears. And really the two extremes on the right and the left are kind of scaring everybody in the middle. And I think that's – you see a lot of fear coming out as a result of that. But Bill's right. It's awfully hard to follow, and it's a very complex issue.
Well, and you've made the point in your writing, Steve, that really we shouldn't panic about anything until there is a specific plan on the table, because everything is so fluid right now.
That's exactly right. And one of the points I made in one of the editorials was the fact that we have never we have a real tradition of incrementalism in government. We don't transform. And here's a situation where we've got a very complex issue, and generally health reform is usually tackled when the economy is really good. You know, if you look at the state of Texas, Medicaid and children's health insurance programs are both expanded when the economy is good, and they get contracted when they're not. And so we're really swimming upstream trying to do what we're doing now, and I think that's also part of the resistance.
And that leads us to one of your chief concerns, Bill, is how we're going to pay for all this. Whether we agree that it's a good thing or not, there's the question of the bottom line.
Right. And let me say up front, I think it's a good thing and a smart thing that we try to figure out a way to do healthcare better than we do it in this country. And I think there is, that is an absolutely rational argument on Obama's part. The question is, how do we end up financing in a surefire way whatever bill comes out? And, you know, the proposals so far in the House, there are three different versions of a bill. In the Senate, there's a separate bill, and the Senate Finance is working on yet another bill. And these costs range from at the minimum $600 billion up to a trillion. And my concern is that our public debt right now, before we get into this, is $11 trillion. And that's really only the beginning of the story, because when you factor in the unfunded promises to Medicare and Social Security over time, the public debt is really $56 trillion. So, you know, we have just gone through a bailout of the auto industry. We're doing it through the financial services. Perhaps they're all good arguments for that. We've done the stimulus package, and I think people, perhaps as Steve was saying, are beginning to wonder, well, how much of this can we absorb? And that is one of my main concerns. In fact, I would say we shouldn't do it unless we have a surefire way to finance this thing.
Because once we do it, there's no going back.
Right. And Congress, doesn't like to take away benefits. And that's my concern about a government plan. It isn't that I'm here to argue the brief for insurers, because I don't think that. And if we were starting out in a level playing field and we had no public debt, I would be very open to having a public plan that the government is setting up. There's a reason. I understand that. But we're looking at a plan that's going to cover people basically from the ages of 25 to 64 the way Medicare does. And we are unable to finance Medicare as it is. The trust fund governing Medicare is going to go dry in 2017. And so we're looking at perhaps, nobody knows for sure, maybe 40 million people being put on this new public plan if employers start dumping them on there. How are we going to pay for that over the time? And how are we going to pay for it, especially if more benefits are guaranteed? I'll stop there.
I want to talk for a minute here about insurance companies, because they've been really vilified in this whole debate. And mm-hmm. It's funny, because there are some studies that say that, upwards of 80% of Americans are pretty happy if they have private insurance. Of course, we all know we don't think about our insurance until we feel it's failed us in some way. And then we have the worst insurance company ever, and they're greedy. I mean, how important is it that we sort of really consider them part of this solution, as opposed to setting up something that in many ways sort of goes directly against them?
Well, it's absolutely critical that we include them in the discussion. It's again, we go back to traditions, and they're actually very powerful interest groups, the insurance companies. And right now they're on board with a lot of the reform. But I think part of the reason is the fact that they see business expanding for them. So it's really in their best interest to do that. If you look around the world, most of the – when you have insurance companies, even when they're private insurance companies, the vast majority are nonprofits. And here in this country, you've got mostly for-profit insurance companies. Now, Blue Cross Blue Shield Texas is nonprofit, but most of the rest I was just looking at a story this morning where, the CEOs of the private insurance companies make millions of dollars, in some cases tens of millions of dollars a year, and people look at that and really resent it, and particularly when there's a lot of issues regarding when they rescind insurance. They look very, very miserly. But at this point, until we're willing to turn them all into nonprofits, that's – they have to be part of the discussion. The other thing I think is interesting about the insurance companies is they are really not against the cooperatives, and I think because they see that that's really not a threat.
Yeah, that's the new buzz phrase. Right. Sort of out of nowhere this week, we're hearing now about cooperatives. How exactly would those work?
Well, I can't tell you exactly how they work.
Let me take
a shot at this. Democratic Senator Kent Conrad, who is on the Senate Finance Committee, has been one of the ones who has been championing this idea. So it's not coming from Republicans. It's coming from a farm state senator. And it basically would be modeled on the way dairy co-ops may work or other farm co-ops may work in rural parts of Texas and elsewhere in the country. I was doing some research on this. Evidently, in Texas, back in the 40s, we had one of the largest healthcare co-ops in the country. And I believe it was backed by one of the farm agencies, farm bureaus associated with the government. Whatever happened, they pulled the backing back, and that kind of went away. But there is a precedent for this. It isn't new. It has been done before in terms of health co-op. Here's what I kind of like about it. It is – Steve brought up incremental. I do think we do incremental change. I don't think that's necessarily bad. This is an incremental way to start getting into a public plan of some sort. Let's try it. And Massachusetts, for example, is starting its own state public plan. And what's being talked about in Senate Finance along with these co-ops is to let each state have the power to set up their own state plan that they like the way they like. And that way we can test it and to see how many people want this sort of public option, which is different from a Medicare-like plan that the federal government runs, see how well it works, see what it does to cost, see how much it costs us to finance this over time. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, maybe then we have the discussion to go to a larger public plan.
There's two primary models for cooperatives. One is called the integrated health system. Kaiser Permanente in California does this, where it's not just insurance, but it's also healthcare providers. So it's sort of a vertical sort of organization. So you can do it with the healthcare providers plus insurance, or you can just do insurance only. The problem is that the ones that are most successful are several decades old, and You know, it took them several decades to get there to become successful. So I'm a little skeptical in that the government can somehow motivate people to create this cooperative. And you look around at all the cooperatives around the country. You know, there's agriculture cooperatives and energy cooperatives and milk cooperatives. And all those are run by very motivated individuals. And here we're kind of seeing the government trying to motivate people to do this. And I just can't I'm skeptical as to whether you can take sort of these islands of excellence when you take the, you know, Kaiser Permanente and there's a cooperative in Seattle that does very well, and then try and duplicate them across the country. It's very, very difficult because there are some parts of the country that are very inclined toward wanting to do cooperatives, and some do not like the whole concept of cooperative. So it can also be kind of a regional thing.
I hear Kaiser. Were they the ones who pioneered the HMO system?
Yes.
Which turned out to be far less successful than anyone had hoped.
It started strong, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, HMOs, there was a period in the 90s where after the Clinton effort to reform health care, where HMOs really were squeezing cost out of health care, and the rise in medical costs were coming down. They were the increase was coming down, and so they did work. They worked for a while, but the public didn't like it and rebelled against them, which is going to lead us to another discussion here at some point about how do we ration care in this country? Because that is something we're going to have to get at sooner than later, whether that's through the marketplace or that's already through what Medicare may cover or not cover. That's kind of underneath this debate.
Well, and it seems to me the one thing that is missing here is that U.S. consumers, at least in the past half century, haven't really had the option to ration their own care because of the insurance system that we've had and the public health care system as it exists. Nobody really knows what anything costs. There's almost no way to walk into a physician's office and have a general sense of what the care is going to cost you, because there's different levels of pricing depending on who's paying. How important is it that we consider transparency at the top of this list of things we have to achieve?
That's absolutely critical, particularly for those that – and you'll hear more on from the conservative sides and the Republicans, where you talk about consumer-directed health care, and you – have to – I mean, that is absolutely the first thing you have to have is transparency. I mean, if you really do expect people to shop for the most effective and cost-effective care, you've got to be able to tell them what it costs. I explored doing what I thought I needed, which was a hernia surgery three years ago, and I literally went in and said, what does this cost? And the doctor couldn't tell me. He said, go to the front desk. And so I walked to the front desk and said, what does it cost? And they all looked at each other and to me like I was from Mars. So you really can't do consumer-driven health care or expect us to be inform consumers without giving us the information. So that's critical from that end.
And I think that's one of the good things coming out of this debate. There are a lot of reforms and items that there's a bipartisan consensus about, and that happens to be one of them, that we can all know how much, you know, a procedure cost or a treatment cost. That's one of them. I've been really surprised how quickly everybody's gotten around the getting rid of the prohibition on insurers being able to knock you out if you have a pre-existing condition. And, of course, all of us as consumers like that. Well, that's pretty much on both sides of the aisle. That's a done deal. That's something that's going to happen. So there are a number of things that are happening because of this discussion.
We're talking with William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News and Steve Jacob of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram about the healthcare overhaul, the debate, the fact and fiction involved in the whole thing. You're welcome to join us, and we already have people on the line at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new, Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about the proposed healthcare overhaul with Steve Jacob of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Thomas in Dallas. Hello, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say that some of the perennial best performers in insurance and investment and banking or nonprofits or co-ops, you know, whether it's credit unions or what have you. So, you know, we should not confuse the healthcare market with a regular competitive free market enterprise. You've got layers and layers of professionals, and, you know, the customer can't be right when you're buying professional, you know, advice from people. You don't even know if you're well served. And all these people, the insurance companies are subsidizing health care for all these people, and we're just doing it in the most clumsy way. So you ask how we're going to pay for it. It's not that it's necessarily expensive. It's going to take an outlay to transition. Even the public option is supposed to be paid for by the members. Obviously, they recently did a study to take about $100 billion to fund all these co-ops. That really isn't that much money in the scheme of things. And to consider that we'd be getting covered, all these people who aren't. Remember, just 22 people in Fort Worth cost just EMS $800,000. You could insure them for $200,000.
Thomas, thanks very much for your call.
I think Thomas brings up an important point in that when we talk about, you know, energy co-ops and food co-ops, it's one thing to buy commodities and to kind of negotiate that down. If you're a co-op in healthcare, and you're insuring people, you've got to figure out and you've got to get that actuarial science right, because if you don't do it right, you're going to lose your shirt. And it's much, much more complicated to try and do a health co-op than some of these others. And again, there are some very, very smart and motivated people that run very successful co-ops around this country. And it's a very popular model. And when it works great. But it's in healthcare, it's very, very risky.
Well, the other point that Thomas brought up in his call was that to a large extent, we're already subsidizing indigent care and other kinds of care, because you and I both know that a $14 Tylenol in a hospital in no way reflects the actual cost of that pill. There's overhead built in that also includes caring for people who will not pay.
Right. And that's one of the rational reasons we want to try to come up with a better healthcare system. So that's one of the reasons we want to do this. We also want to do this so we can change in a larger sense how doctors and hospitals get reimbursed through Medicare. And that's one of the reforms that are being talked about from Barack Obama over to former Medicare Chief Mark McClellan, who's here from here in Texas, that they're discussing other ways to reimburse doctors and hospitals instead of doing fee-for-service. You get it, by and large, on the quality of care you deliver, and there are incentives in there for doctors to do that. So that's the sort of way we want to, you know, this phrase you hear called bending the cost curve. That's one of the challenges before Congress, is to have a set of reforms that'll help us control not only how much the Tylenol costs, but whatever, you know, our overall national health costs are like.
For the average Texan, the cost shifting you're talking about, where those who are insured have to pay for those who are uninsured, and again, we have the highest uninsured rate in the nation here in Texas, we pay about each $1,800 of our health premiums every year go toward covering this indigent care or charity care. Right. So it's big bill.
But let me inject one more time this debt issue, because what I'm concerned about, we could create a worse problem. You know, we are headed right now towards our largest, the most serious debt to GDP, gross domestic product ratio, since World War II. In other words, our debt is consuming more of our economy, our gross domestic product each year. And the way it is projected over the next 10 years, we're going to be back where we were in 1950. And the problem is that our economy can't sustain that over time. And we're either going to have, I don't know if they're Gen Yers, Gen Xers, whoever they are, they're going to have to be paying exorbitant tax rates. Children today are going to be faced with that. Grandchildren are going to be faced with that. So let's be very cautious. While we can all understand the reasons we want to to get more people insured so we don't have to pay through the back door for this stuff. We don't want to pay $20 for a bottle of Tylenol. All of that makes sense, but let's don't create a worse problem by the way we set this up.
I didn't look this number up this morning, and I should have, but the last time I looked at it, I think healthcare as a percentage of GDP was something like
16.
16. Okay, I thought I was thinking 14. And that's projected to continue rising. Is there any way to put a cap on that, do you think, through a new kind of healthcare system, or will our increased medical technology and the ability to know that we can be made better by these technologies increase demand regardless?
Well, at this point, it's going to increase demand regardless. What we do, and you often hear the United States has the best healthcare system in the world. And when it comes to delivery of care, that is true. When it comes to financing that care and the fairness of that, we are really lousy. And at this point, up to this point, really the primary debate has been about access and delivery of that care as opposed to the financing of it. So at this point, nothing in those bills indicates that we're going to do anything other than, you know, layering this really lousy financing of healthcare on top of our current system. Regardless of how much we expand it, but if we expand it, we're just simply going to get in a bigger, a deeper and deeper hole, as Bill points out. So, until you're willing to talk about how you're going to reimburse physicians differently, until you're willing to talk about, I don't know, delivering nonprofit insurance. There's a number of ways you can do it, but they're all very, very politically either unpopular with the voters or very unpopular with big health, which is capital B, capital H, which, to me exceeds big oil, big energy. It really is the most muscular but, lobby in Washington.
But I'd also say some of this has to happen at the local level outside of Washington, the federal government suggesting it happen. And to some extent, I think there are conversations going on among hospitals here in Dallas about how they can deliver care better and differently. Scott and White is, in Temple, our Jim Landers on our new staff has been writing about it being one of the 10 best hospitals around the country in terms of the way it delivers care. Quality care and at a good cost. And if a Scott and White can do that in Central Texas, I have to imagine that a Baylor and Presbyterian and these institutions here can get together and figure out a way, not get together in a way that breaks antitrust laws, I guess, but figure out a way that they can do what Scott and White is doing or Cleveland Clinic is doing. And I concede there are islands of excellence, and it will be hard to duplicate that nationwide, but we still need to start with these islands of excellence, and then we need to get more communities trying to adapt them or adopt them, or else we aren't going to be able to control that 16% a year increase.
One thing that really hasn't come up so far in this debate very much, and certainly not today, is what maybe takes us into moral and ethical territory, which is always difficult when you only have an hour. But is it reasonable and fair for people who say, look, I have insurance. I'm paying for insurance for my family. It's a lot, but I got it taken care of. I can't worry about what everybody else who's not covered right now or who has chosen not to take coverage if they can't afford it. It's not fair for me to be asked to take on the burden of their care.
Well, I'm going to argue against the point I raised earlier, is let's be very cautious about how we do this, because that is my overriding concern. But having said that, there is a reason that we as society want to do healthcare better and differently than we are. And you've brought this up already as a good example. Instead of having people go to the emergency room where perhaps, certainly the care would be less efficient if they went to a primary care physician, but the cost could be greater too, because they may wait until the very last moment till something gets bad and they go, now I got to go, and it's going to cost more. So, we end up paying for that through Parkland and through John Peter Smith. We pay one way or another. And I think it to that person who feels like, look, I have myself taken care of. Well, you are paying for these other people's care in another way, too. There's got to be a better way to do that.
The sentiment that you expressed there, Chris, is exactly what's being reflected in the opinion polls that really come out weekly, done by Gallup and the Kaiser Family Foundation and all those groups, which is essentially that overwhelmingly people want to cover everybody with insurance because they know it's tragic not to have it. And then when they're pressed, particularly those people say, yes, we want these people covered, and you give them scenarios about how much it's going to cost them. So the approval rating for that goes from, almost 70% down to the 20s. So, people want to be empathetic, but they also want to protect their pocketbook. So
let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Bonnie in Rockwall. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick comment. I'm intimately familiar with Kaiser Permanente. I grew up in California. I think it's a wonderful system. We hardly paid anything as far as copays. I think they've got it dialed in. Moved to Texas. I'm looking at a $6,000 copay to fix a nerve issue on a foot. My son's jammed a stick through his hand, went to the emergency room. Children's was wonderful to write some of that off. Cost us a year's worth of payment. I think some of the states have great models. And I want to know if these employers in those states are receiving extra incentives for providing better health care coverage. And then my second comment is really a concern. Liberty in any society is only equal to the amount of personal responsibility people are willing to take. And I just came out of Walmart and saw a woman who looked like she probably spent a lot of time at the gym with a little grade school kid that could have rolled down the street. I am a little bit angered at the idea of taking care of preventable lifestyle diseases. And I just want to know if that's going to be forced down our pockets, to take care of diabetes in children who are, she had a donut when she was leaving the store. That kind of stuff. Where's the education?
Bonnie,
for wellness.
Thanks very much for your call. And interestingly, she brings up two things that you've each sort of separately written very passionately about. One is the idea of incentives for employers. And Bill, that's something that you have a problem with.
Well, the problem I have, and it's more of a tactical problem. I get covered through my employer, so maybe I shouldn't argue about this too much. But employers are able to get a tax subsidy from the government to help purchase insurance for people like me. And the argument has been that, well, we ought to put a limit on that subsidy each year because in some cases, employers may be providing gold-plated health insurance plans, and the public is, in effect, subsidizing that. The amount of the subsidy each year is pretty big, very big.
And we should say this is how the healthcare system became what it was, because
correct.
Employers wanted to provide additional benefits without paying extra taxes
on
it.
Right, and I'm not necessarily arguing against that. We've just reached a point where if we're going to do something differently, we're going to need a revenue stream. To me, this actually goes back to last year's campaign because John McCain proposed this. He would propose eliminating this tax subsidy the businesses get, give everybody a voucher or a subsidy, and you go out and buy your own insurance. That model's not being talked about today, but there is a discussion on the way about putting a cap on how much employers get in terms of subsidy, turning around and using that revenue as a way to pay for this $1 trillion plan over the next 10 years.
And Steve, let's go to the question of obesity and the problems that this country has. There has been a lot of talk among supporters of this plan that health prevention and making sure that we all sort of start out healthy and protect our own health is going to be important. You've looked for evidence-based data that would suggest that this actually works and found very little to convince you.
That's correct. Prevention is a great idea, and you do it for quality of care. But if you go looking for cost savings, you're not going to find them. Screenings, annual physicals, all those things, if you sort of mandate them, it becomes very, very expensive. So I think you can't really look to prevention in that way to save money. What's often, and I think what the caller was talking about was people get very angry when they see somebody, puffing on cigarettes and way overweight, and they're very concerned because they are paying for those people's choices. And in a piece I wrote a couple weeks ago, I think we pay, and I think it's specifically in Texas, $259 a year on top of what we already talked about with the cost shifting for obesity-related care, whether you're obese or not, or the non-obese pay that for the obese. So, but where do you go from there? How do you prevent that? Some people have talked about putting taxes on unhealthy food. Well, you have to determine what unhealthy food is. Do you charge obese people and smokers more for insurance? That is kind of a non-starter too, because I'm not even, first of all, you have to see whether it and in fact be legal. But at this point, insurance is that we're kind of all in the boat together, and we're all kind of taking care of each other. And even if you don't necessarily agree with what somebody else is doing, at this point, you are going to subsidize that.
But and Steve is right. There so far, at least, there has been no convincing data to say that preventive health care is going to generate cost savings, particularly immediately. It's good for public wellness. But I would also argue it's good that we go down this road for another reason, somewhat the caller is talking about, and that is perhaps more personal responsibility as we consume health care. And I'm doing this off the top of my head, but basically in the employer model, the employee pays for about a third of the premiums, the employer is about two-thirds. So, you know, I'm arguing against myself here, but I think perhaps we will be better shoppers if we're paying for more of our own health care. Nobody likes that, but that's one way we become better consumers. And I think when we become better consumers, we want to know things like, how much does this procedure cost? You need to tell me. Are you doing everything you can to be efficient in the way you deliver services? All those things we have a greater interest in occurring because it affects our bottom line.
Well, it's interesting in healthcare because I think in some ways we've sort of the culture that as we've created it sort of infantilizes us in that if your car breaks down, you find the money to fix it or you don't fix it. In the healthcare system, you no matter how bad it is, you sort of don't imagine yourself paying out of pocket if you don't have coverage, which is very different from any other things that we might repair in our lives. We got a few seconds.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Basically, I think you're talking about if you've got insurance, that is the case. But if you don't have insurance, that is exactly what happens. If your car breaks down, you can't repair it. In the same way with your body. If you don't have the money, if you don't have it in your pocket, you can't heal yourself.
We're talking about the healthcare overhaul debate with Steve Jacob and William McKenzie. We'll be back in just a moment. You can send us email at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about the potential healthcare overhaul with William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News and Steve Jacob of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. We have an email here from Teresa in Dallas who says, I would love for the government to create a standard payment a doctor can charge for a service. When times get tough, drug companies, doctors, and hospitals charge more without any competition or evidence of how they really need the increase. Is there any chance that the government might set fees? Anyone talking about that?
Well, that's what would happen if you had a basically a single payer system.
Which is now off the table.
Yes, it is. I mean, that's pretty much you set fees through the public insurance, which is about half of health care in this country, through Medicaid and Medicare, and the Children's Health Insurance Program all have set fees. But if you're privately insured, it's a floating number, and you know that physician you generally. Negotiates that with the insurance company, but you know it depends on what those terms are. And you know, as consumers, we really are not kind of privy to that. We just pay our premiums, and it is what it is.
And you remember during the Clinton debate in 1993 and 4, there was a big pushback by doctors who were very upset about how much control HMOs and other insurers had over their rates. Similarly, today. We hear on our editorial board regularly from doctor groups who are very concerned about the rates being set by Medicare and Medicaid. This all goes back 10, 12 years to the 1997 Balanced Budget Act, when one way they were realizing savings was to change the payment rates for Medicare and Medicaid. And over time, that has continued through one reform after another, and all every couple of years, the doctor groups come back and say, wait, we're dying, we're dying, we're dying. So to her call, this, you know, this is being done. Doctors don't like it. In fact, that's one reason you see the House bill jumping up in cost, because the House, in my words, bought off the doctors by saying, okay, we're going to give you higher reimbursement rates. And then, lo and behold, AMA came out and said, we like the House bill because they're going to get their $240 billion in higher rates. So, you know, their rate's being set, and there's a lot of angst in, among doctors and providers about those rates.
We haven't talked much yet about malpractice reform, but a lot of doctors will argue, look, we're not as rich as everyone seems to think we are. A lot of this money that we take in goes to paying to make sure that we can continue to do business if something goes wrong with a patient.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with the president on this. We have done a very good job in this state with malpractice reform. Basically, I think the limit is $250,000. Mm-hmm. And at this point, the federal government is not inclined to kind of match that. And there are some things that there's some impact there. Number one is obviously the medical malpractice premiums paid by the doctors. But there's a lot of defensive medicine being practiced as a result of that. It's not as huge a portion of the inflation as people seem to think it is, but it is a factor. Right. So in most other countries around the world, there's just not a culture or a tradition of suing your doctor. It's either the malpractice premiums are either paid by the government or they're so low because almost, you know, doctors go through their entire careers without being sued, and your average doctor here in this country gets sued multiple times, regardless of how good they are.
And by defensive medicine, you're talking about additional tests that might not really be necessary to get a baseline of what's
That's correct.
What's
and in other words, what they think about is if I'm going to be called on the witness stand and have to defend my course of care, what do I have to do in order to be able to defend myself?
The Committee for Responsible Federal Budget put out a list of ways to save money in medical care. This is one of them, but it was also way down the list in terms of the amount of money it would save, way far behind a number of other reforms. It's sensible. We should do it. We have done it in Texas. Hope we do it around the country, but it is not going to be the big enchilada.
Let's go next to Carrollton and speak with Tom, waiting very patiently. Hi, Tom.
Hi. This healthcare debate has been really sort of depressing and I'm a serious person. It's illustrated the need for campaign finance reform after seeing the influence of the $5 billion that the pharmaceutical and insurance companies have given Congress over the last few years. Example, Max Bock is the number one recipient, has been totally corrupted by it. It's also shown the poor quality of the media coverage, again, I think because of influence. The news departments are now part of multinational corporations. But the only quality media coverage I've seen on this issue, and I've watched a lot of it, has been Bill Moore's Journal on PBS. But the experts on his programs raise some points that should be dominating the debate and they're hardly being heard. For example, you know, the U.S. pays twice as much per capita as the rest of the world for health care, and one of your guests even calls it something about being the best in the world. And that's simply not true. We're ranked 37th in the world, just below Slovakia. And the dominant statistic that should be the only thing really being discussed is the projected savings of single payer system over 10 years, $4 trillion.
You are starting to break up. I do think we have your basic point, and I very much appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
Yeah, the caller makes a great point. When I said that we have the best healthcare system in the world, I was strictly defining it by delivery of care. When it comes to outcomes, which is what he's talking about, we rank very low, and that gets into a whole different set of situations, primarily because we have tremendous disparities in this country. And I think it goes back to the fact we have a very high uninsured rate. And for, you know, a significant percentage of this country, you know, was 15%, is probably now creeping up to 20%. Their health care is out-of-pocket health care. If they have it in their pocket, they'll pay for it. If they don't have it, they can't do it. And again, many, many countries around the world, particularly developing countries, that's how healthcare is delivered. The rich get treated and the poor just get sick and die. And there's probably, I believe it's 20,000 people a year die of treatable conditions in the United States, and that's because they simply cannot get the care because they can't afford it or don't have access to it. So he's right. We don't rank very well on many, many, many measures, and we are at we are at the bottom of the heap of all our peers, all the industrialized nations in terms of outcomes.
There's also the question of economic productivity when you cannot pay for health care. You know, if you work in a sort of blue-collar job and you get a back injury and you can't pay for it, outside of workers' comp, then you're just out of the workforce.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to challenge a caller. I think the media actually is doing a good job in covering this. And I know I point to Jim Landers on our staff who's been writing very thoroughly about how you control costs. NPR has been covering this debate, nonstop. Your paper, New York Times, they're putting a lot of resources into covering it. So I think we are covering it. The problem is, as we've been talking about, it is such a big debate. And Obama is right. It is hard to do big debates. That's why I tend to think we may end up doing some of this incrementally. By the end of the year, maybe that's where we will end up. But we need to have these kind of discussions. For this reason also, we're going to eventually have to take care of Social Security, and we're eventually going to have to take care of Medicare in addition to what we're doing now. And those discussions are going to be equally difficult. And we need to figure out a way to do this respectfully and have a good discussion back and forth and try to find where that proverbial sweet spot is.
I'm going to make a prediction. I think we're eventually headed toward universal health care, and I think that's going to happen in about 10 years. The situation is this. It's not gotten bad enough. It's not creeped enough into the middle class for there to be true change, true transformational change. And again, I think you alluded to it, Chris, in that for the most part, the vast majority of Americans are pretty happy with their health care at this point. But because of the way costs are going to continue to go higher and higher, it'll put it all of us more and more out of reach. But we haven't reached that point yet. And once we do, I think we'll have true transformational change. And my guess is it will be some form of universal health care, whether it's a single-payer system of the government or whether it's government-financed and private doctors, or whether doctors can become employees of the government. Who knows? I mean, there's a whole array of models out there, but we're not there yet. And honestly, I don't think it's going to happen during this Obama administration. And if he gets reelected, the next Obama administration. But I think it's going to get that bad in about 10 years. And I think Bill alluded to it, too, because of, the demographics.
What do you think about that prediction, Bill?
Well, I can't go out that far. I don't know. I think what is going to happen in terms of politics in the next 4 months, here's my guess, is I think that the House is going to lose out to the Senate. The Senate's going to come forth with some sort of modified package, and we'll see whether it has enough votes. And if it doesn't, then I would keep your eyes on a bill that Democrat Ron Wyden, Senator, and Senator Robert Benton, Republican from Utah, have, which is kind of a slimmed-down version of things. It's kind of like the old football. It could just come right up the middle at the very last, and that could be the thing that people get behind. The fact is none of us knows at this point, but I tend to think the Senate is going to win out. Just look at this co-ops debate. Senator Conrad, others have said, look, there are just no votes and not enough votes in the Senate for a public plan, period, in the conversation. Obama's smart enough to recognize this and said over the weekend, okay, I'm open to co-ops. And so that's why I think this debate is going to play out.
Can the Obama administration be judged a success if this ultimately fails, if nothing passes after we argue about this for however many years?
It's going to be interesting because, this really is the same template that happened in the Clinton administration. He tried very early on to do health care reform. It failed. He moved on. But the headwind, or I'd say the tailwind he had, was the fact that the economy was great during his two terms. Most of which had nothing to do with what he was doing. So he was able to regain his popularity and his standing among the American people and in the world because we had great economic times. And here, in Obama's case, he's spent a lot of political capital doing this. And when this is all over with, we're still going to have a really lousy economy that has not recovered. So it'll be very interesting to see if he can rebound from this.
Sure, I think he can rebound. And I think you will need to learn the right lessons from this if this goes down. I think if this goes down, it will go down in part because people are worried about how much we are having to absorb right now. Again, we talked about at the beginning of the show, whether it's the financial bailouts, the car bailouts, the stimulus packages. There's only so much that people feel like we can take on right now. And again, going back to this public debt, people worry about those things. You're starting to see it. And so the question is, will Obama learn enough from this to be more of a new Democrat as he goes in Bill Clinton-like fashion? But he's a very good politician. I think he has all the skills. If he loses on this thing, no, I don't think he's history.
It's interesting, though, if the Clinton approach of top-down didn't work and the Obama administration of bottom-up doesn't work, you have to wonder how anybody,
right,
Republican or Democrat, could frame this argument.
I feel for the president on this. If you recall Bush when he was trying to reform immigration, we had two bouts at it in 06 and 07. And I know that the White House was told in 07, back off, let us kind of do this and kind of give us the parameters. So they kind of backed off and they kind of were talking to the Capitol Hill back and, you know, back channels and all that. And the thing didn't work. In a way, you're darned if you do and darned you don't. Clinton tried to go top heavy. Obama's trying to go, you know, grassroots, let Congress do it, back off. I don't fault the presidents for the way they're trying this. I just don't think there is just one magical way.
I wrote about this bill that Bill mentioned up. That mentioned was the Wyden-Bennett bill. And I, during the campaign, I said, oh, here's what Obama's saying and here's the problems with that. Here's what McCain's saying and here's some problems with that. And this seemed to be kind of the best of those plans out there, and it involves, you know, using private insurance companies, but it there's an individual mandate there, and again, that's another piece that's getting lost in this whole debate, and it's interesting that that's been sort of submerged because that's going to have to come back up again. You know, not only do you have to talk about how you are going to bend the cost curve again, reduce cost of care, but you also have to decide, are you going to make everybody get insurance or not? And again, nobody's talking about that because everybody is talking about other stuff. So there's a lot of issues that once we get past what we're talking about now with the death panels and all this other stuff, there's a whole host of other issues that need to be handled.
Very quickly, in a word or two, people don't necessarily trust government. They don't trust media. Where do you go when you're trying to understand what is being proposed and sort of navigate that?
Well, I go online and read kind of what the bills are, you know, the proposals are about.
Mm-hmm.
Or I try to find online sites that have a good breakdown of information. I will say New York Times has a wonderful one on the prescriptions blog they have. You know, I go to our paper. I go to a number of different sources.
That's Bill McKenzie, Dallas Morning News. Steve Jacob?
I'm part of the media, so I do tend to trust the media more than most people do.
Gentlemen, it's been great to have you. Thank you very much. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.